Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Happy Monday, everybody. If you have taken the weekend off from following world news, you should know that, unlikely as it seems, the situation in Syria got even more complicated while you were off doing the five-borough bike ride, rising and falling with the Knicks, or whatever you did. Israel bombed inside Syria two times, reportedly going for Iranian missile shipments headed for Hezbollah in Lebanon. And this has further intensified the debate over whether the U.S. should get militarily engaged against the Assad regime, because Israel got in and got out so easily. So with that as a starting point, we welcome Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, it's great to be with you again.
And first, let me play two clips from CBS Face the Nation yesterday, which seemed to suggest some bipartisan unity and caution, I think, rather than division, about how far the U.S. should go now. Mike Rogers and Dutch Ruppersberger, the top Republican and top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, seem to agree we should be the coach, not the sheriff, when it comes to intervening in Syria. Here is the Democrat, Ruppersberger, saying we should not get directly involved.
But we can't be the sheriff for the whole world. We have our own issues right now, Iraq, Afghanistan, we have sequestration, those type of issues. So when we move and make the move to get in, we have to do it with a coalition.
With a coalition. And so here is Republican Rogers. If you thought he would say, oh, you Democratic wimps, we have to go there and take charge. We're the leader of the free world. Not quite. The Intelligence Committee chairman.
And we really don't want to be the sheriff, but we do want to be the coach. That's where we can bring the most impact. And why this is important, you have 8% of the trade goes through the Suez Canal. If this spills out of control, and that's worldwide trade, imagine what impact that has on prices here at home, on the economic development here at home. It's spilling over in the region right now. What, and it's led by Iran. Yep.
And again, that was House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers. So what does that exchange mean, Susan? And do you understand the difference between a sheriff and a coach?
I thought that exchange was interesting in that they are both saying that we need to do something more. Ruppersberger said when we go in, not if we go in. Mm. And Rogers talked about some of the imperatives for doing more. But the idea of being the coach and not the sheriff, which I think is a pretty elegant phrase, actually, means that what does a coach do? Stands on the sideline, maybe shouts in signals, possibly provides some equipment, but doesn't send in U.S. troops, possibly doesn't provide U.S. airstrikes against Syrian defenses. It seems to me that is a distinction that is meaningful and that both of them seem to be embracing.
And by the way, in my intro, I should have said, since this coach analogy came up, did you rise and fall with the Knicks and the Nets this weekend? So not to leave out the Brooklyn fans who really fell and lost their coach, but that's another story. But John McCain says the ease with which Israel struck should embolden the U.S. to use cruise missiles or other weapons to wipe out Syrian air defense positions on the ground. So is McCain just being McCain because he's always relatively hawkish on this? Or does he represent a main line of thinking in the Republican Party?
Well, I think McCain is always McCain, almost always. A few periods there that when McCain was not McCain when he was running for president, but he wants to go to. He's very eager to use U.S. military power. I think when the White House hears a phrase like, it was easy. Look how easy it was to strike Syria. They hear echoes of the buildup to Iraq. Remember, welcomed like liberators.
It'll be a cakewalk.
That war will be easy. It'll be a cakewalk. And it, of course, wasn't. Just recently extricated ourselves from that. I think there's another parallel with Iraq that the White House hears, and that is the argument over whether chemical weapons are being used by the Syrian regime. One reason I think the White House has taken a hard line in seeking proof that the regime is actually using chemical weapons and in a considerable way, in a large way, is also a part of the lesson that they felt they learned in the lead up to the Iraq War. But to your question about whether McCain represents a broader mm-hmm. instinct in the Republican Party, I'm not sure. I think McCain is always on the leading edge of urging more military action. We've seen with this Republican Party, there is perhaps less interest in doing that than in the Republican Party we had a decade ago.
Listeners, should the U.S. act now in Syria? And if it should be a coach and put together a coalition, how should that work? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Which country should be the point guard? No, I'm just kidding. 212-433-9692 if you want to get in on this. There's also a New York Times report today that the U.S. secretly considered airstrikes before the Israeli ones over the last few days. So I don't know if you've been able to independently confirm that at USA Today, but could the U.S. have been Israel's coach on that Israeli series of downs?
We have not confirmed that New York Times story. But we know, here's what we already know. We know that Israel used American-made weapons. We know that we believe that they used U.S. intelligence in those strikes. And we had President Obama coming out in an interview with Telemundo saying that strike was justified. So whether the U.S. was the coach or not, the U.S. is clearly supportive of what Israel did. And we also know that for months the U.S. has had plans for escalating U.S. involvement in Syria. But the problem has been, or the issue has been, that the president has not approved that, even over the advice of then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, then Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and then CIA Director David Petraeus, all who've moved on from those jobs for different reasons, even when they were advising a more activist, a bigger U.S. role.
Dave in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dave.
Hi. I read a report today on Talking Points memo that there were reports that the rebels actually had used sarin gas. So there's some evidence of that. Does your guest know about that? And I guess that complicates things.
Susan, do you know?
Well, I don't know. We know that there have been reports and concerns about chemical weapons use on both sides, although we think the big stores are ones with the regime. There's also some concern that the rebels may want to convince the United States that chemical weapons are being used by the regime because that will draw in stronger U.S. support. And that concern, I think, is one of the cautionary flags that the Obama administration's been looking at.
Yeah, because the president didn't say it directly. The rebels might have used the sarin gas. But I thought the implication in the president's statement the other day that we're still looking to confirm if it was used, who it was used by, that kind of thing, was to say we don't really have the fingerprints of the Assad regime on the sarin gas, and it's certainly conceivable that if some group of rebels wanted to draw in the U.S. or a broader international coalition, which you would think that they do want to, that if they were actually willing to go to these lanes and kill about 30 people with chemical weapons so that everybody goes, oh, my God, it must have been Assad. It's not inconceivable.
Not inconceivable. That's one reason the administration has insisted on a higher level of proof and a level of proof that may not ever be reached, given the difficulty of sending independent investigators into Syria.
Rita in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rita.
Hi. I'm against sending troops into Syria because I think, it always rebounds back against us, and it's also a lot of innocent people will get killed. How about doing a drone strike on Bashar al-Assad? That would get rid of the problem, you know.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Can they go after Assad as an individual and from the air like that?
Well, we've done a lot of targeted assassinations with our drone program, but I think there's a presidential directive of long standing against the assassination of foreign leaders, given our unhappy history with attempts to do that.
Considered a line, even for all the controversy over drone strikes taking out terrorist leaders, there's considered, I guess at least in the eyes of the United States, a legal distinction between a head of state like Assad, even if we don't think he really has legitimacy, and a terrorist leader in the mountains somewhere, right?
Yes, I assume that's right. Yes, absolutely. There's a debate about that. But, Rita, I think, reflects a lot of U.S. public opinion, and we don't see a big groundswell on the part of the American public to do anything that puts American lives in danger in Syria. And there was a Pew poll in April that even said if they clearly are using chemical weapons, a weapon of mass destruction against their own people, would you support U.S. military action? And a plurality supported of Americans said they would support it, but it didn't get up to 50%. Mm-hmm. And that has to be in the back of the mind of the administration as well.
Mike in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Okay.
A question in all this discussion about using violence, going to war perhaps in Syria, there's been no real discussion about the role of Congress. Shouldn't President Obama be going to Congress for an authorization to use force? That's my question.
Thank you. And it's always a great question. And in the last, since Vietnam, I guess, maybe even Korea, a legally fraught question.
Yeah, well, of course, Congress thinks that the administration should have to go to Congress for authorization, and that's what the War Powers Act was all about. But no White House has acknowledged that, although the tradition has been notifying Congress when military action is about to be undertaken or has just been undertaken. So my expectation is whatever the administration decides to do in Syria, that is the tradition that they're going to follow.
David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, Brian. I feel that the UN was created to prevent Holocaust and hasn't done its job. Now we've lost almost 100,000 people. If that's not a Holocaust, I don't know its definition. I think we need to do something to prevent Holocaust, Syria, wherever it is.
Thank you. So, yeah, people are saying 100,000 as a credible number of the number of Syrians killed since the uprising began. What is the UN's role here? And when we hear, you know, these members of Congress talking about a coalition in the clips that we played before from Face the Nation. Is it a UN Security Council declaration, an official world community action, or is it some kind of more ad hoc coalition? Or where does the UN come in, do you know?
Well, the preference for the United States would be if the Security Council adopted a resolution that authorized military action that would be joint. However, Russia is on the Security Council. Russia has been an ally of Syria in this, almost certainly would block that resolution. Now, Secretary of State Kerry is going to Moscow this week, and it's certain we expect in his discussions with Vladimir Putin to raise this issue. But I think the United States does not think it is a realistic prospect that the Security Council would approve that kind of resolution, and therefore you get to more of the kind of ad hoc coalition that we've seen in various hotspots around the world.
Nadia in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nadia.
Hi. Hi, Brian. I have a lot of respect for your program, but I'm very surprised to hear that you're so easily talking about Israel attacking Syria without any consequences from United Nations or from any criticism from people like you.
Well, thank you for your call. Is anybody raising this Syrian sovereignty question, even in, you know, the current chaos and the entire world calling Assad illegitimate? It's true that there hasn't been a lot of pushback that I've seen in most places for these Israeli strikes over the last few days. But do you see anybody raising that as an issue? After all, they are going into Syrian territory. Now, maybe it's an act of self-defense because they say they're going after missiles that Iran is trying to ship through Syria to Hezbollah in Lebanon to use as offensive weapons against Israel, so Israel can make that case. But how much is that becoming a controversy around the world?
Well, Nadia is right that the only people I've heard objections along those lines are from Syrian officials who objected to the Israeli strikes. Of course, Israel hasn't acknowledged, I don't think officially, that these were their strikes, although
that's correct.
That's what we're assuming.
They don't as a matter of policy, though there seem to be unofficial acknowledgments.
Exactly. And one other element that might make this different is that I don't think Israel's motivation here is Assad. I don't think it's involved. It's a part of the civil war that we see in Syria. It's an attempt to destroy weapons and the ability to supply weapons by Hezbollah to Israel's opponents to Israel's foes. So I think that combination of things, the lack of an official acknowledgement that they're behind it, and also the self-defense characterization of the strikes makes it a little different than if we went in, for instance, because Syria does not, there's not a Syrian threat to the United States. It's a more of a moral obligation because of the civil war or concern about the use of weapons of mass destruction or desire to topple Assad. So it would be different for us, and I think it is the motivation for Israel.
Susan Page, USA Today Washington Bureau Chief, as we talk about the developments over the weekend in the Middle East and in U.S. and international diplomacy regarding the Middle East. And I want to use our remaining few minutes to turn the page and talk about new revelations of deep unhappiness among the U.S. diplomats in Libya with the way the Obama administration spun the Benghazi attack last September, including on the part of U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice, contradicting the Libyan president right on Sunday morning talk shows back in mid-September about whether it seemed like a planned terrorist attack or not. So just to refresh people's memories, here is the president of Libya speaking on CBS Face the Nation on Sunday, September 16th.
It was planned, definitely it was planned by foreigners, by people who entered the country a few months ago. And they were planning this criminal act since their arrival.
So that was Libyan President Mohamed Magariaf on Face the Nation. Here is Susan Rice that same morning on Meet the Press.
This is a response to a hateful and offensive video that was widely disseminated throughout the Arab and Muslim world. Obviously, our view is that there is absolutely no excuse for violence and that what has happened is condemnable. But this is a spontaneous reaction to a video, and it's not dissimilar, but perhaps on a slightly larger scale than what we have seen in the past with the satanic verses with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad.
So Susan Rice saying it was from those spontaneous demonstrations about a video, the president of Libya saying it was a pre-planned attack. And now we have, Susan, the number two U.S. diplomat in Libya at the time, we are told by CBS, Greg Hicks, saying he was humiliated by this. The president of Libya was humiliated by this. They only ever had information that it was a terrorist attack, a planned attack. And we ruptured our relations with the new Libyan government for a time because the U.S. went out and spun it the way that it spun it. And this, of course, drew a political reaction on yesterday's Face the Nation from Republican Congressman Daryl Issa.
Ambassadors know that the one thing you don't do is contradict your host, especially at a time when you need their cooperation. This was a fatal error to our relationship, at least for a period of time. And we can't find the purpose. Secretary Clinton should have been above all else, the person who was on the same sheet of music with the Libyan government, and she wasn't.
So from what you could tell, Susan, how significant is Hicks coming out and saying this now? And if he so objected to Rice contradicting and embarrassing the Libyans back then, and she was so clearly wrong in his view, why did Hicks wait this long to speak up?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. We may find out on Wednesday when Mr. Hicks is testifying before the House Oversight Committee on this issue. I think this is a tremendously significant disclosure on a controversy that had sort of faded away on the Benghazi talking points because it definitely reinforces the view of administration critics that there was, at the least, misinformation being put out. Mr. Hicks, according to the CBS report, based on Hicks's interview with the committee, said that there was never any question about who was behind those attacks. And, you know, we heard Daryl Issa, who is, of course, a big administration critic, no question about that.
Partisan Republican, he will do what he can exactly to weaken the Obama administration.
But, of course, that doesn't mean he's always wrong. When he talks about the Obama administration, he says you don't contradict your host. Well, especially you don't contradict your host if you know your host is right. And according to Mr. Hicks, the administration knew at that time the nature of this attack and was misrepresenting it to the American people.
whether it was to preserve the Obama campaign's line that General Motors is alive, Osama bin Laden is dead, and this was a very tough and successful administration on terrorism, and not to get another storyline out there. That, of course, is the ultimate political charge. So I guess Benghazi coming back into the headlines with that report and the hearing that will take place on Wednesday, including Mr. Hicks. Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, as always, thank you so much.
Hey, Brian, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll come back to the Middle East later in the show when we meet an amazing human rights activist whose whole family could win the Nobel Peace Prize. Maryam al-Khawaja and her kin are trying to democratize the Arab Spring country of Bahrain through nonviolent resistance. Theirs is called the Pearl Revolution, and we will meet Maryam al-Khawaja later in the program. But coming up next, the lawyer for John Liu fundraiser Oliver Pan. Pan convicted of a straw donor scheme last night. We'll see if we can get any closer to the question of what Mr. Liu knew and when. Stay with us.